I'm Matěj Skalický and this is Czech Radio News Podcast, Vinohradská 12. Iran's nuclear program. How hard have the Americans hit it? Why is it so difficult to find out? And what happens to hundreds of kilograms of highly enriched uranium? Daria Dolzikova, a senior research fellow with Russia's proliferation and nuclear policy program, is today's special guest on Vinohradská 12. It's Saturday, July 12th. Hi, Daria. Thank you very much for joining us on this podcast.
Thanks so much for having me.
The U.S. strikes, according to the Pentagon, have pushed Iran's nuclear program back by 1 or 2 years, but earlier U.S. intelligence reports said it was only set back by a few months. So what's the truth?
Yeah, so I think the variety of assessments that we're getting in terms of how far the program has actually been set back is a good indicator of actually how challenging it is to assess how much damage has actually been done and what the impact is. And I think that's for a few different reasons. I mean, number one, it's hard to know how much access U.S. intelligence has to those facilities, or at least information about the state of those facilities, how much access the Israeli intelligence has, frankly, how much access the Iranians have to some of those facilities, considering that some of the facilities might have been caved in or very heavily damaged. So I think even just from a practical perspective, it might be quite difficult to assess how much damage, physical damage, was done. But also more broadly speaking, when we look at how far a nuclear program is from developing a nuclear weapon, or how far a program might have been set back either through, you know, diplomacy or military attacks, there's a few different aspects that we have to consider. And it's not just the physical aspect of it, right? So part of it is, yes, the physical capability, the centrifuge numbers, mm-hmm. the numbers of facilities, the amount of fissile material. That's certainly an important part of it. There's also the know-how, the expertise. And yes, we know that the Israelis have targeted and assassinated a number of senior Iranian scientists. That will no doubt have an impact on the state of the program. And again, how far it's actually been set back in terms of how quickly they can reconstitute the program. But also there's the question of political resolve, right? So how far the program has been set back physically is one aspect, but also we need to consider what have the last, what, 2-3 weeks done for how the Iranian leadership thinks about their nuclear program and what they need it for, and whether they actually need to reconstitute and potentially even move further and push towards a nuclear weapon. Mm-hmm. And whereas the physical aspect might have been set backwards, there's, I think, the valid question of, do we run the risk that the actual political resolve, the strategic thinking, that there's been an mm-hmm. opposite effect on that, and that that's actually hardened?
A lot of questions, but it seems that Donald Trump, American president, has a really clear answers, because he claims that the program was set back permanently. He said the facilities were completely and totally obliterated. Is that even possible?
Well, again, it goes back to, you can obliterate the physical aspects of them. Mm. And, you know, as far as I can tell from where I'm sitting, it doesn't seem like they've actually obliterated all the facilities. Yes, some damage has been done, but they've not fully eliminated them. But I mean, aside from that, going back to what I was saying earlier, you know, this is a program that is very, very advanced, or has been very advanced. It's been developing for decades, right? This isn't something that they set up 2 years ago. This is a program that's been entrenched for decades, and that has crossed over not only several changes in leadership in the current Iranian government, but has crossed over from different regimes in the Iranian government, right? This predates the Islamic Republic as well, the nuclear program. So the program is, like I said, quite entrenched, and critically, the expertise is quite entrenched, right? So yes, you can destroy the physical aspects of it. And again, it doesn't seem that even that's been fully destroyed. But more importantly, it's a lot harder to destroy the expertise, right? And the ability to reconstitute if they did decide to reconstitute.
You've already mentioned the question of accessibility. It's true that Iran's president Masoud Pezeshkian, in an interview with Tucker Carlson, admitted that the nuclear sites were seriously damaged, but some of them are still inaccessible. We can believe him or not, but he said that. So the Iranians don't even know how bad the damage is yet.
I mean, I can only go off of what the Iranian authorities, the Iranian government is saying, and some of what we've seen from the intelligence assessments. But yeah, I think that's a reasonable thing to assume that the Iranians, I mean, depending on the level of the damage and if some of the entrances were sealed off, they might not have had the chance to fully assess the extent of the damage.
Masoud Pezeshkian also said in the aforementioned interview that Iran isn't against international monitoring of its nuclear program. So how come they cut off cooperation with the IAEA?
Yeah, so Iran's relationship with the International Atomic Energy Agency has been, I guess, a bit of a challenging one in the sense that the Iranians have normally been, I mean, relatively speaking, cooperative with the agency. They've been allowing access as per their comprehensive safeguards agreement with the agency. They've been allowing IAEA inspectors access to their facilities. So we've historically had a decently good sense of what the program looks like. But historically, again, the Iranians have used access by the agency, and kind of denying access or allowing access is a little bit of a negotiating tactic as well. So they've, you know, threatened to and actually withdrawn previous to this, the permissions for not inspectors generally, but certain senior inspectors to access facilities. They've rolled back access and visibility by essentially turning off some of the cameras that were in place in those facilities by the IAEA. So the point being that they've used their relationship with the IAEA as a little bit of a diplomatic lever in the past as well. This, of course, is quite a massive step if the Iranians are to be believed in terms of legislation that they passed, if they're going to institute it, ending all cooperation with the agency is quite a significant step. And the argument that, you know, they've made in the past is that, well, you know, the agency has, or allowing access by the agency to our facilities hasn't actually prevented them from being militarily attacked. You know, the Iranians have gone so far as to accuse the agency and the Director General, Rafael Grossi, of being complicit and facilitating, I guess, or justifying at least the attacks carried out by Israel and the US. I mean, I would argue that's quite a bit of an overstatement and a very unfair assessment of, first of all, the agency's role, but also the agency's ability, right, to stop the kinds of things that we saw over the last few weeks, the military attacks on Iran's facilities. So, you know, I think that's probably an unfair assessment of, like I said, the agency's responsibility and what it could have done. But that's where, I guess, the frustration for the Iranians is coming from. But, I mean, more practically speaking, by denying access to IAEA inspectors, it does create a certain level of uncertainty, right? The agency normally is able to verify where Iranian material is, what Iran is doing with it, to what level it's enriching, that creates or that allows for some visibility. If the Iranians pull that back, then they're very much in charge of formulating the narrative of what they're doing with the material, what the next steps might be, etc. So again, it's an additional point of leverage for them as they move forward.
The U.S. Army attacked nuclear facilities in Natanz, Fordo, and Isfahan. Can you give me, if we specifically concentrate on Natanz and Fordo, can you give me a more detailed picture of how the facilities actually look like? What's done there? What's inside?
So Natanz and Fordo have been Iran's enrichment facilities. So basically, you need to, when producing fissile material, when producing uranium for either use in nuclear weapons or use for nuclear energy, you need to enrich the uranium to certain levels. So for use in nuclear reactors, normally we're looking at, depending on the reactor type, but we're looking at about 3-5% uranium-235. For use in a nuclear weapon, normally we're talking about 90% uranium-235. You can make nuclear weapons with lower levels of enrichment, but the point being that essentially you need to enrich natural levels of uranium, or natural uranium rather, to uranium enriched in U-235. So that's what was happening at those two facilities. It was enrichment, uranium enrichment. So at Natanz, there were two enrichment facilities. There was the above ground uranium enrichment site, the pilot fuel enrichment plant, and that one had three cascades of centrifuges, and those cascades can have, you know, over 100 centrifuges in each one. So that's still quite a significant number. And that facility included advanced models of centrifuges as well. So those are the more efficient ones that enrich uranium more efficiently than the less advanced models. So there was the above ground facility at Natanz, and then there was the biggest uranium enrichment site that Iran has, and that one was underground at Natanz, the fuel enrichment plant. So that one contained 82 cascades of centrifuges. And again, and those can have, you know, up to over, well over 100 centrifuges as well. So that was the biggest enrichment facility. Then at Fordow, again, another enrichment facility, slightly smaller than the below ground, or actually considerably smaller than the below ground facility at Natanz. It had 13 operating cascades of centrifuges. But the critical aspect there is that's where Iran was producing the majority of its 60% enriched uranium. So again, just to go back, the levels of enrichment that we'd normally expect to see for weapons grade is about 90%. So 60% isn't quite there, but it's quite close. So that's where Iran was producing the majority, not the only place they were producing 60% enriched uranium. They were also doing that at the pilot fuel enrichment plant at Natanz. But Fordow is where the majority of that 60% was being produced. And it was being produced using advanced centrifuge models. So again, the more advanced ones as well. And Fordow, again, critically, that was the site that was particularly deeply buried. So I think 80 to 100 meters underground, or 80 to 90 meters underground is what I'd seen in public reporting.
Oh, that's a lot.
So yeah, so it's quite deep, mm-hmm. which is why the United States needed to get involved for that facility, because Israel doesn't have the munitions or the aircraft to carry the munitions that are necessary mm-hmm. to penetrate that deeply.
And this is also a reason for the bunker buster bombs that were dropped on both Fordow and Natanz. But I've seen a report from one of the top U.S. generals who told the U.S. senators that only Tomahawk missiles were used against Isfahan facility. Why?
The Isfahan facility also has underground aspects of it, but it looked like the aim there might have been primarily to close off the entrances to the facility, as opposed to, you know, a Fordow, where it looked like they were trying to actually fully penetrate the facility based on what we know of the munitions that they likely used. So yeah, at Isfahan, it seemed that the objectives might have just been slightly different for the type of damage that they were hoping to cause to the facility.
General Duncan, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, reportedly explained it by saying that the facility in Isfahan is too deep underground. So what lies deep underground in Isfahan? Enriched uranium stockpiles?
So that's where we believe that Iran has historically kept its enriched uranium stockpiles. Now, then this goes for all of the facilities as well, not just at Isfahan. But one of the challenges, and this goes back to your earlier question around how much damage has actually been done, one of the challenges in assessing that is that we don't actually know what might have been moved in advance of these strikes.
That's what you wrote back in late June, that supposedly it was moved to hardened locations.
Yeah, so that's what the Iranians have said, that they moved their material to other sites in advance of some of the strikes. Now, again, because the IAEA has not had access, and because now IAEA inspectors have left the country reportedly, that material is going to be a lot harder to track down and to assess where it is and what state it's in.
So the uranium is now missing. We don't know where is it, how much uranium we're talking about.
Yeah, so the concern is over the highly enriched uranium. There's about 409 to round up kilograms of highly enriched uranium, enriched to 60%, that as of the end of May, so the IAEA assessed that was the stockpile that Iran had. And yeah, so the concern is over whether that material has been moved, where it's been moved to, and you know, whether Iran could potentially use that material to enrich it to higher levels if it decided to move towards weaponization.
Would the possible relocation of the uranium be detectable, for example, by satellite images? Because I can't imagine, how is enriched uranium transported?
Yeah, so that's a good question. I mean, enriched uranium is normally transported in canisters. Those canisters are normally, if you know what you're looking for, you could potentially track it on satellite imagery, but the canisters are not massive. So I think, you know, especially in the context of a war zone, if you don't know, I mean, Iran's a very large country. So if you don't know what you're looking for specifically or where it might be going, if that material was not expected to be moved from particular site A to particular site B, I mean, you're looking for a needle in a haystack at that point. So it'd be really difficult, I would assume, to identify that. I mean, I say that, but there are some people doing some open source intelligence work that is really quite impressive. So, you know, I wouldn't put it past them, but I would imagine that would be quite a hard thing to track if you don't know specifically what you're looking for and where.
If Iran can move its enriched uranium stockpiles, could it also move its centrifuges?
Yeah, again, technically possible. These machines are fairly sensitive, but they are movable. They're moved. you know, I think the thing to keep in mind as well is, you know, when we're talking about Iran reconstructing its facilities or its ability to, you know, if it decided to move towards a nuclear weapon to do that, the thing to keep in mind is, you know, there's a reason why Iran's infrastructure was as large and as dispersed as it had been, right? It creates a certain level of redundancy. Precisely for the types of scenarios that we're seeing now, Iran wouldn't have to reconstitute the whole program. It could use, you know, a few cascades of centrifuges in a much smaller facility, probably very deep underground, probably undisclosed, to, you know, enrich sufficient material to further levels for a nuclear warhead. So the concerns over the potential to move centrifuges, but also concerns over where additional centrifuges might have already been, right? So part of the rollback of the IAEA access that Iran has been going through really over the last few years is that Iran had rolled back IAEA visibility of its centrifuge production and centrifuge storage. So it is possible that, you know, some centrifuges might have been put in facilities that the IAEA did not have access to or was not aware of even before these military attacks. So they might not have even had to move any centrifuges. I'm speculating a little bit, right? We're in a bit of speculation land because we don't actually know all the details, but, you know, it is technically possible that, yeah, there might have been stocks of centrifuges elsewhere already. So moving of centrifuges might not have even been necessary.
A few days ago, I read a report from you in which you wrote that we still don't know what happened at the site in Golang Gazla, but the US planes didn't bomb this location, did they? So why is it important? What's there?
Well, yeah, so I've not seen any further assessment over whether that was one of the sites that was targeted or not. You know, we know that they targeted Natanz, that other facility, the Golang Gazla facility that you mentioned, is not far from the Natanz complex. So, you know, I don't know if that was included. I haven't seen any additional assessment on whether that was included in the strikes. It doesn't seem like it was. But again, I'm being very careful because there's still a little bit of unknown around what was actually targeted and to what extent. But yeah, so that facility is even deeper than Fordow. It's very deep inside of a mountain. And that facility was being constructed. The Iranians said it was for centrifuge production, but you know, it's possible that they could potentially engage in enrichment at that facility as well.
You said many times that it's so hard to find out what happened, how big the damage is, and how many months or years can take to restore the nuclear program in Iran. Do you think that we will have more answers in the upcoming weeks or months?
Yeah, I don't know. That's hard to say. Again, it depends on what access is available to the intelligence agencies, whether that be American or Israeli. It depends how much access the IAEA is able to regain as well, right? So there is the possibility that the Iranians, and they said that they would allow IAEA access and cooperation under certain conditions. So, you know, I think if the agency was able to regain access to the program, then that would certainly help in assessing how much damage was done and what the state of the program is. And frankly, I think that should be the priority at the moment. They're the most credible. The agency, the IAEA, is the most credible source that we have on these kinds of questions. But again, I think it'll still be hard to assess what the quote unquote the damage is, because again, for a number of reasons, because some of these things are not physical things that we're assessing, right? Part of the decision making is precisely that, the decision making, the strategic calculus. That's really hard to quantify and to assess. So that'll be difficult. But also, I mean, there's the question of how far the program has been set back from what? From the production of a nuclear weapon, of multiple nuclear weapons, of, you know, the status quo ante, the way it was before the attacks. As I said, the Iranians don't have to reconstitute the whole of the previous program if they decided to move towards a nuclear weapon. So there's, you know, the metrics are a little bit fuzzy, but also the actual data that we're using to assess is challenging because, again, some of it's not quantifiable, namely the political decision-making, the strategic calculus.
Thank you very much for all your answers.
Thanks so much for having me.
And that's all for today. I spoke with Daria Dolzikova, a senior research fellow with RUSI. Thank you for listening.